You all right?
Yes. Can I give you one of these?
Sure.
You hold it about where you would like a sort of, just a standard stand-up comedy microphone style. A little tangled.
That's a bit of an understatement.
It's true, true.
Jeez, God. Yeah, there we are. There just trying to get as much.
Thank you.
It's one of my passions in life is untangling things.
Oh, tremendous. Well, you're welcome then.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is an Emmy, Golden Globe and Double Olivier Award-winning actor, director, writer and producer. When it comes to stage and screen acting, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more authoritative or better-credentialed figure. Long before he was playing instantly iconic roles in Hollywood, be them in Troy, Rob Roy, Braveheart, The Bourne Identity, X-Men 2 or Adaptation, he was and remains a powerhouse of the stage, playing the Duke of Burgundy to Laurence Olivier's King Lear, Brutus to John Gielgud's Caesar, and the titular Titus Andronicus, and then after decades as a character actor came the role that would lose him any remaining anonymity. The sociopathic patriarch Logan Roy in Jesse Armstrong's Emmy magnet Succession. Last week, we spoke for an hour in his dressing room at the Wyndham's Theatre in London, where he's been playing another problematic father figure, James Tyrone, in Eugene O'Neill's A Long Day's Journey Into Night, opposite Patricia Clarkson and directed by Jeremy Herrin. And with a voice as recognisable as Brian's, I think it's only right that he announce himself. So, please welcome my guest for this episode of Spieling the Beans,
Brian Cox.
Brian, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome.
In your foreword to your incredible memoir, Putting the Rabbit in the Hat, Frank Rich writes that he first saw you on stage in 1985 in a Eugene O'Neill play, Strange Interlude. And we're in your dressing room at the Wyndham's Theatre, where you're playing James Tyrone in another Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey Into Night. Mm-hmm. What is it about O'Neill that so appeals to you?
Well, it was very hard to discern initially what appealed to me. He just happens to be the great American writer and great poet. He's also a poet. His writing is full of the incredible poetry. But also, what's more important to me, well, there's two things, actually, two separate things. As a theatrical animal, as an actor, I'm very impressed by his... The way it was way back, actually 50 years ago, I severed my Achilles tendon, and I couldn't work, so I spent the summer reading the entire works of Eugene O'Neill.
Oh, wow.
I can't remember much about it, but what was interesting is the range of how he viewed the theatre, how he would embrace the Greeks, he would embrace Shakespeare, and there was a certain sense of... And clearly it was, you know, clearly it was from his background, his father being the actor that he was, that he had a passion for the theatre and a passion for writing. And particularly he was poetic. And also very, very complicated ideas, like the idea that's in Strange Interlude, to speak your thoughts, the masks he used in Dynamo, I think he uses masks. So there was his way of dealing with theatre and dealing with theatre in an adventurous and in a new way. And also he was part of a movement that was beginning to kind of separate itself from Europe. You know, Henry James, who's very much the kind of American-European writer. Hang on a second.
Sure thing.
Hello? Sorry, I'm on the... busy. Sorry, are you okay with that?
Yeah. Yes, no problem.
So I was very... I just thought he had something quite unique, in a sense. And so, therefore, as a writer, creator, I was just fascinated by his imagination, by his energy. But the other thing, which I've discovered latterly, really, is his Irishness. How much his Irish, you know, that kind of literary thing, you know, the great that Ireland has. I think Eugene O'Neill is very much part of that. He's part of much. He's very much in that tradition. So, and when you get to a play like Long Day's Journey Into Night, the root of it are these emigre Irish and how they were treated, and how James O'Neill, James Tyrone in the play, had made a kind of success of his life through his own compromise, which he regretted later, the Count of Monte Cristo, which his house in New London is named after. It's called the Monte Cristo Cottage. So he was very much... the father kind of resented the fact that he was locked into that and that he didn't be the actor that he was. But also, he reflects on his Catholicism, how he was steeped in that. And also, being Irish, how the Irish were treated, particularly by the Yanks. Because Yanks were usually people who were associated with being kind of from the Mayflower, the original Protestants who came, and they were not very tolerant of the Irish. But they were caught between a rock and a hard place, because Eugene and James O'Neill was also a Matinee idol, so they didn't quite know how to treat him. And O'Neill made his mark. He went to church regularly. He wasn't a particularly good churchgoer, but when he was in New London, he always went to church to show that he was, as it were, in proper, sure. You know. And it was so that, and Gene captures all that, and in a kind of, as sadly as a man, I don't think he was a very happy man. I mean, you're not happy if you grow up for 23 years of your life and your mother is a morphine addict, so sure. you don't really have any parental relationship with your mother, and of course your father was on tour a lot of the time. So as a child, as an infant, he was quite, you know, he lived a lot with his grandmother, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of alienation that's in him too at the same time, and then when he goes to the sea, and also he intuitively doesn't have enough. Well, he does have he actually came to love his father very deeply, but he also understands the problem of playing the Count of Monte Cristo for 5,000 times.
Sure.
But the Irish element is very powerful, and the Catholicism element is very powerful. And also, everybody says it, and I think it's true, that this is probably the finest American play of the American plays there are. I mean, you know, we have Arthur Miller, we've got Tennessee Williams, you know, and they're great plays. But because of the biographical element of this play and its ramifications, anybody who comes to see it all identifies with some strain of, whether it's the alcoholism, whether it's the addiction, whether it's the alienation of the brothers, whether it's the frustration of the father, and poverty. That's the other element, which is the element that I identified with, how you come from poverty to that success. But the poverty never leaves you. It's sort of, I know in my life, it hangs over me like a Damoclean sword, so I'm always worried about earning enough, and yet at the same time, personally, I never want to know what I earn, so I never pay any attention to it. But at the same time, I'm anxious to think, am I going to run out of money? It's very primitive, that fear.
Totally, and as you rightly say, there's so much to identify in the play as a whole and in individual characters. How much is a character defined by an actor versus a director?
That's a very good question. It depends on the actor, and also depends on the director.
Sure.
Jeremy Herron, I think, is a really interesting director. His visual sense is very strong. So he has a real strong of how you... And he creates it... He does create it like a painter. So he comes to the... You know, he's got ideas which are great ideas. And that the visual realization of that sort of grows throughout the evening. And actually, it tells when you go on stage, you feel totally safe, because you know visually everything is in the right place. You know, that's what the world that we've created.
Yeah.
And we've gone down, and with this particular production of, with Jeremy's production, we played the love of, the much more about the love affair of Mary and James. So the opening is, because it's very hard to play because of trying to identify when is the point they realize that she's fallen off the wagon.
Yeah.
And so you have to play not that, but you have to play that she has not fallen off the wagon very much in the first act. So there's a sort of joy about her and her coming back and her being healthy and everything and how difficult it's going to be for her. And then, of course, the proverbial hits the fan and sure. we go from there.
In the construction of that, how, as an actor, do you like a rehearsal room to be run? And as a director, how do you run yours?
Well, it's the thing about, you know, I've just done a series of things called a maestro class. Mm. And what you realise is that young actors, it's very difficult for them. You know, it's hard. Mm. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's not an easy thing to learn. And you always, everybody stands in their own way. Mm-hmm. They just have to be kinder to themselves. Mm. You know, there's all the old disciplinarian things, but really, it's such a delicate subject. It's such a delicate thing being an actor in many ways that you've got to be kind to the person who's doing it in order to let them release what they can release and show what their imaginative potential is, you know. And I very much encourage that as a director. And I try to work that way as an actor. And as an actor, I'm constantly putting things into the mix, or even taking things out of the mix as the evening goes. Not with the central spine of it. The central spine is intact because that's important in terms. But and especially with James O'Neill, because so much of the time he's on the receiving end, which also makes it really emotionally very difficult because he becomes quite exhausted until the fourth act when he is finally revealed in what his life has been. So, and that's the greatness of the writing. But in the earlier scenes, you have to pepper it with stuff. You have to really understand, and it's all to play with hope. It's going to be all right. She's going to be cured. Oh no! How am I going to deal with this? What's going to happen? What's the new tact about dealing with her? Yeah. Trying to persuade her not to go down that road. Trying to stop, but of course she becomes further and further gone. And as he says, by the end of the night, you'll be a mad ghost if you don't stop now. So, and he's lived with this. You know, James has lived with this. So there are all kinds of things that are offered up to the actor, which the actor should go and grasp hold of. And, of course, it always helps when all the actors are on the same page in that way. So they're all able to kind of do that thing of adding their texture, as it were.
Is that what you found with Michael Elliott? You described him as one of the finest directors you've worked with.
Michael was very much that. He really was. He was considerable in that way. But he also had a great intellectual sense, and he was very good at understanding the script. I mean, I remember when we did an Ibsen play, when we did Awaken, with the wonderful Alexander Knox, who was a Canadian actor and very, very fine actor, and Wendy Hiller. It was one of my first jobs. I was so miscast. I mean, they didn't think I was miscast, but the character I was playing was in his 40s, and I was only, what was I? I was 24, I think, when I played it, even 23. But I always looked older than I was. So, but what I discovered from Michael, there was a wonderful session where they were doing a scene and Alex, who was very, you know, very profound, very serious actor, suddenly at one point he says, "Oh, well, this is cup of coffee acting, isn't it? You know, when we're just having it." And he said, and Michael said, "No, in Ibsen there is no cup of coffee acting. It's always on the edge." That means that you have to find a way of softening the edge, because you can't be relentless in that way unless it's a play like Brand, you know, where you can be relentless, because that is a relentless play. Peer Gynt, you couldn't be that, because that's a circumventing play. He circumvents everything, whereas Brand goes hard to it. And Ibsen, to me, is a wonderful writer in that way, because he yields up that. But Michael, as a director, was able to establish that there is nothing casual. And that also implies to doing Long Day's Journey. There is nothing casual. There's an appearance of casualness, but it hides and masks something else, you know.
Yeah.
Michael was he was an extraordinary director, and he was a director of the interior of the play, and it's something that I find is missing from a lot of directors now. Oh, yeah. A lot of directors are so conceptual bound, that they have great concepts, but there's a sort of sometimes an organic misunderstanding where they don't understand the organic nature of a play, and they don't understand the way the playwright operates. And it's a different animal. You know, I mean, you can get sensational productions like this, James Graham's This England, for example, you know, which physically is an amazing production, done by Rupert Gould, I think. And, yeah. You know, it really works incredibly well. And it serves the play brilliantly and it enhances the event. Now, that works, but there's sometimes when directors are putting their own little... their tale, and I'm not really interested in them. I'm more interested in what's the playwright is doing, you know.
Yeah, I'm very pleased you mentioned Dear England, as both James and Rupert are coming on the show after you.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, and I had a similar experience as you. That rings true with what you're saying about Michael Elliott awakening you to a love of the text.
Yeah,
the text is first.
And the text is master. I mean, that went right back to my training with Vivian Matalon when I was a student. He was a great teacher, a good director too, but he was a brilliant teacher. Mm. And he used a sort of the Sanford-Meisner technique, which is technique of objection, of objectives. You know, what are you doing? What's my intention? Why am I on this stage? Those basic questions, which will then spark off all kinds of other questions. Mm. You know, it's not like, you know, the Americans have fallen into the whole Strasbourg notion of, you know, of the emotionality of something. And you cannot have emotion without thought.
Sure.
Thought leads to emotion. It's the thinking that hits you into the emotion. You don't go, oh, I'm... And it's very fast.
Yeah.
You know, it goes boom, you know.
Otherwise, presumably, it's just incredibly primal.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah.
So, converse to Elliot, then. Your work with John Schlesinger didn't go as smoothly, one could say, as
well,
the previous one.
In fairness to John, it was... you know, John is a delegator and is a wonderful film director. And he, as a film director, he lets everybody do their job. In a play like... And he was not an experienced Shakespearean director, because it wasn't his field.
Yeah.
So, in a way, he had a brilliant cast. The costumes were I didn't think served us. They probably weren't as bad. In fact, when I look back on it now, I don't think it was as bad a production as I thought it was at the time.
Okay.
I mean, one of the problems with it was that. You need someone. The Mark Antony was problematic, to be honest with you, I felt, you know, because you need someone of incredible charisma to do that. And the guy who played it, No Names, No Pactville, didn't have quite, I mean, he was a good actor, but he didn't have that cunning and cleverness that Antony needs.
Yeah.
I played Brutus, and Brutus is a much more circumspect character, you know,
he
much more circumspect. And, I remember John's thing was, he kept saying, make me understand it, make me understand it. And of course, in order to make him understand it, one would go slower, you know. And of course, you can't do that in Shakespeare. Mm. You have to, it needs volition. It needs to follow the iambic. It needs to follow the thing through.
Yeah.
And John didn't have a grasp of that. It wasn't altogether John's fault. It's just not. I mean, he had done Time in of Athens, but then he had Paul Scofield. And Scofield was not me, you know.
Sure.
You know, he was slightly older and slightly more mature as an actor. I was only 31 when I played Brutus, and we had Gielgud, which was wonderful. But Gielgud also was a little bit. He never said anything, but I could feel that he was not 100% happy in the production.
Sure. Did you see the motive and the cue?
Yes.
What did you think of that portrayal of Gielgud, having met him?
Brilliant. I thought Mark. I saw that, and I said, you know, because I knew John very well.
Sure.
And, I mean, I worked with him, and I didn't know him. I mean, I knew him,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I didn't know him deeply, but I knew him, you know, and spent a lot of time in his company. Mm. And I thought Mark captured him incredibly. Mm. He really did. He got something. He channeled John. He transmitted John brilliantly. You know, he's Mark. He's physically not John. But he had something which was so quintessential of John's, you know. I felt that Johnny Flynn, who I thought was very good, but he made one mistake. He tried to do a voice, you know, because nobody can do a voice of Richard. If you're going to do Richard Burton, you've got to do that voice, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, Elizabeth, why do you talk to me like this? I don't like it anymore. And all that sort of enunciation that he had. Yeah. And that was unique. That was, you know, I listen to Burton now, and of course, it was both served him, but it was also a hindrance too at times, you know.
I can imagine, yeah.
You know.
You've said your favourite film is The Court Jester.
Yes.
Danny Kaye. The Vessel with the Pestle. You know this
better. The Vessel with the Pestle. The Pellet with the Poisons. The Pellet with the Poisons and The Vessel with the Pestle. The Dragon with and The Flagon with the Dragon is the brood that is true. No, they've changed it. The Pellet with the Poisons is in the Chalice with the Palace, no longer in The Vessel with the Pestle. I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Norman Frank in Panama directed it. And ironically, the film didn't do well. But it's... To me, it's just one of the funniest films ever. And Danny Kaye is just genius in it, absolutely genius.
What do you love it so much? Why does it that warrant the
funniest
film?
It's funny. It's as funny as hell. I mean, that makes me laugh. And if I want to cheer myself up, I immediately go to The Court Jester. Sure. I mean, it was really weird because I had a presentation recently. I presented three films for Turner Classic Movies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which I did in the States. Mm. And... I chose The Last Hurrah, which is a reuniting of one of my very favorite directors, which is John Ford and Spencer Tracy, who had not worked together for over 28 years.
Yeah.
And there was tensions because Ford had a relationship with Katharine Hepburn, and it was all kind of at different times.
Sure.
It was all over, but he was not. And then The Last Hurrah, which I think is a beautiful film, a lovely film. And Tracy, of course, who's a master, is great, and Ford's direction is great.
Yeah.
So I chose that. I chose Lindsay Anderson's The Sporting Life, mm-hmm. which I think is, to me, one of the most incredible. And Lindsay, who I, again, was a major influence in my life. And then the other person I chose was Danny Kaye, mm-hmm. was The Court Jester. But they couldn't get The Court Jester.
Oh, they couldn't get the rights?
They couldn't get it. And they don't know, so we can't get it. And I'm going, this is criminal, you can't get it. You can get it on YouTube.
Sure.
You know, and I just thought, why not? Why not see that, how wonderful that film was, especially in the context of a Turner Classic Movie?
Yes, if they can't get it.
No.
That seems like the prime home for it.
I know, odd.
The Edinburgh Fringe, we both have a very strong connection to. Mm. For me, it's where this podcast started. And because of that, I'm now a director of stand-up comedy and theatre, and I'm bringing my first two shows up this year.
Oh, really?
You've just been named patron of the Edinburgh Fringe. First of all, please come and see my shows.
Well, I'm unfortunately, I'm going to be directing a film during that time, so I'm not going to be able to... In Scotland.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then that's... Yeah. Just pop over on an afternoon. Secondly, why, in your view, is the festival so important?
Well, the festival is just... Well, you know what it's like.
Sure.
There's nothing like it in the world. It's the most unique thing, you know. I mean, people clamoring to see stuff, you know, people performing to three people or people performing, you know, to something they can't get anybody into because it's so packed.
Yeah.
And it's just about the work, you know. And it's a fantastic evocation. My wife did a show called She, Her, which was a unique show because it was all about individual women dealing with their individual monologues, which led to a kind of group event.
Yeah.
And I just think that there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like Edinburgh. Of course, you know, I've known it since I was 17. When I'll never forget it, you know. Going to Edinburgh in 1963, I saw the drama conference, the famous drama conference, when UNESCO was there, when the new lady came across the McEwen Hall.
The Lady Godiva.
Yes,
yeah.
I saw that. And also Jim Haynes doing Happenings just outside.
Oh, wow.
They did Happenings. That was it. And also the most incredible... Because the Royal Scottish Academy, is the art, the paintings there are fantastic.
Yeah.
But they had the Modigliani Sottin exhibition, which still reverberates with me to this day. It was, you know, Modigliani, nobody had seen that kind of work to that range, and it was just stunning. Yeah. So Edinburgh's always been like that. Edinburgh's very much my spiritual home, you know, because I started work at the Lyceum, and it's and it's you know, in a way, it was Scott who kind of Walter Scott who kind of put Edinburgh on the map as a sort of visiting place. So it is a city of celebration, and it is a city of festival, because it's had a lot, you know, it's got the drama festival, the book festival, the comedy festival, the film festival, you know. And it's potent. It's always been potent. It's had its rough times, its rough period. You know, I think the film festival has been through fairly rough times, and it's now finally coming into its own, and has had some good people, some less good people. But the just the whole atmosphere of Edinburgh. I mean, I think both my boys have been to the festival, and they couldn't believe it. You know, they just, and there's nowhere else like it in the world. You know, it's a unique thing. You know, and it's just the best. It's the best. And I've seen some incredible work there over the years, incredible work, you know, which is just never, you know, still sits with me, you know.
Yeah. Well, I hope you get a chance to pop in.
I hope so, if I get a day off.
Exactly. We've got to talk about Succession. It would be a crime not to. You've described Logan as a man who does villainous things, but is not really a villain. What do you mean by this?
Well, Logan's history is interesting. He comes from a situation where there's a deal of tragedy in his life. The sister who died, Rose, which is very interesting, because I always think of Rose. It made me, when I was Rose, it immediately made me think of the Glass Menagerie. Rose is the, and Tennessee Williams had a sister who was ill. You know, she actually lived much longer, but his sister was his kind of, and, you know, he adored her, and of course he had his problem with his mother and what have you, but and the sister, and he's got that great speech, Laura, I tried to leave you behind me, but I'm more unfaithful than I intended to be, you know, that he couldn't leave the image of his sister.
Yeah.
So I used that because, and it's, the thing about Jesse and his genius is he has these backstories, but of course you never play the backstory. The backstory is there just to feed and give the creator, the character, a sort of dimension.
Yeah.
And I figured that that was the one thing that about Logan was the death of his sister was something that prompted him to be more ruthless in a way.
Sure.
And that he probably started off being quite left-wing, but drifted more and more to the right because of, I understand why that is. It's a great temptation and it's understandable, but it's that way folly lies, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But for Logan, he decided he was going to be in charge of whatever it was. Mm. So there was a great journey towards this thing and also his relationship with women. Mm-hmm. And he's not very good with his children, you know. But also, the other thing is, And it's true, I have, you know, my children, my two sons, my youngest sons, who are, one's in their 20s and one's about to be 20, and they find it hard because they've had a lot of privilege in their life, you know, and that hasn't necessarily helped them, you know, and in a way, sometimes it's easier to come from a hard place to go to a much more equitable place than come from an equitable place, because you're going, what's the dimension here?
Yeah.
And that is what's difficult. So I felt that with Logan, he had made certain decisions, and he just wasn't going to put up with it. I mean, he keeps sacking people, but he always rehires them. He always rehires the people he sacked, because they're his family. Mm. And I've always said that the family is as much to do with you know, Frank and David Rash's character and Jay, of course, Jay's, they're as much the family as the workers are. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they're more reliable in many ways, even though he has a frustration.
Yeah.
He can't deal with his own children because they have that entitlement, that curse of entitlement. And they behave in ways that are not they're not viable to him, you know, and that's why it's very, I mean, all he wants to do is find a successor within his own family.
Yeah.
That's what he tries to do. So we have four episodes where we're dealing with that. And there's, you know, there's Kendall, there's Shiv, and then there's Roman. And that takes up most of the time. And then, of course, the fourth episode. So, and, you know, I suppose initially the one he wanted to run the show was Shiv.
Yeah.
But she can't stop talking. She cannot, you know, she is, she is so kind of, there's a sort of deep insecurity about Shiv. Kendall's ambitious beyond belief, but he's also troubled, you know, deeply troubled. Roman is the most possible one, but he's got a potty mouth, and his potty mouth is always going to let him down, so he's left a little bit quietly in despair about these children, you know,
yeah.
Which is why I knew at the end of, I predicted, you know, because I'd followed the line of the character, that the person who would benefit would be his son-in-law, would be Matthew, Wormgarms.
When did you spot it was going to be Tom?
I spotted it right at the end of the third series.
Oh, with the sort of, was it the Godfather tap on the shoulder?
And not only that, it was before that when I saw Tom, when Tom showed me an act of kindness. If you remember when I have the UTI, he helps me.
Yeah.
And I think that made a huge effect on Logan. We never play it, but that knew that this person was right. He was proper. He was caring. He was understand. And he wasn't out for himself. I mean, he is to a certain extent, but not in the way that his children are. Yeah. And also, he's somebody who's going to learn and somebody who's going to run the business quite well. And then with Alexander Skarsgård, Madsen's character, you know, you knew that was going to be the right combination. And of course, it came as he won. I also think that Logan would have liked Roman to succeed, but Roman always shoots himself in the foot. Mm. And he's got to grow up. He's not quite grown up yet. If he did grow up, then he was probably the most viable successor, because he was the one who sorted the problem out in the episode two when we had to look to the Middle Eastern money and how real was that. And Roman cut right to the chase on that one.
Yeah.
So that's the brilliance of the writing. You know, when you've got writing like that, there's no effort involved. You know, you just do it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so there. But it's also because there is this backstory element that you can create. You know, like, you know, simple things like when you see him swimming and he's got scars on his back. Nothing is referred about that.
Yeah.
Nobody over the bar. But we do see there's an element that this person has been brutalized at one point in his life, which is to do with his uncle when he went to Canada and he worked with his elder brother Jamie, who was fine because he's tall and he was fine and he could look after himself.
Yeah.
But Logan was very much picked upon, you know, and brutalized.
Yeah.
So that builds up, even though we don't play any of that, it's just there. It's there in the texture.
Yeah. It seems very similar to the Russian playwrights in terms of everything.
Yeah,
subjects,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
that is good. And of course, when you've got that team of, you know, Jesse, Tony Roach, Georgia Pritchard, the brilliant Lucy Prebble,
yeah.
John Brown, you know, we're very, very lucky. Those guys and gals just did an amazing job. They were just, you know, there was no effort with their work because it was so rooted, you know?
Yes. I've always been interested on a long-running show like Succession when you have multiple directors over a season. The writers stay the same, the cast stay the same, but the directors come in and out. You have sort of principal ones that do the premiere episodes, the finales, but some maybe just for an episode.
Yeah.
What is it like as an actor where the person literally calling the shots is perhaps the least familiar with the characters?
Well, it's it's not a problem, but it's a difficulty.
Sure.
You know, there's a difference between a difficulty and a problem. And it's a difficulty because they'll probably say, I remember one director said to Roman, do you have to move so much? And you go, that's who Roman is.
Yeah.
He can't be still for 5 minutes. So they, I can't remember who it was, but they got that wrong, you know. I mean, so some directors get it wrong, but if you get somebody like Mark Mylod,
yeah,
who just does the most incredible work, you know, and he sets a standard for other directors to follow, you know, he says, there you go. But he's the most unvainglorious person you can meet, Mark. He's much more, you know, he's a worker, you know, he just does the work, you know. I josh Mark because I happen to be, when I come back here into this country, I love to watch old-fashioned, you know, I love Poirot, sure. I love Foyle's War, I love all those cop shows, but I also love things like watching old runs of Hello, Hello and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I watched Hello, Hello and I saw that the floor manager was Mark Mylod. And I said, so I jokingly said, so Mark, I was watching and I could see where you've got the roots of your work. I was very impressed that you were worked on. And he went, and he thought I was going to say some magna. He said, Hello, Hello. I said, no.
You've never seen a floor better managed.
Yes, exactly.
In that episode. How would you sort of quantify then the Mylod style of directing? Why is he so good in your view?
Well, he knows how to shoot it, mm-hmm. and he works well with our wonderful DP, Pat Capone. They have a great relationship together. Mm. He shoots it very much like a play, mm-hmm. so we'll shoot long, he will do a lot of coverage, but he shoots the scenes, you know, he will play the scenes and shoot the scenes as though, you know, we're doing it. It's very much, there's a sort of very strong, not consciously theatrical element, but a sense of how you work in the theatre.
Yeah.
And he does that wonderfully well. He does that. And he, his notes are always to the point. But his sense of the totality is quite something.
On that note of it's quite theatrical and quite like it's like in theatre, I was watching Red last night, the Lucky McKee
film
he did. And because you make note of it in your book that includes a 16-minute take as your character, Adrian Lowe, is talking about the death of his wife and children and how that happened. And although they cut it up in the film, you talk about it being a 60-minute continuous take. How do you feel about that as an actor? Because I imagine it's similar to delivering a monologue. I mean, you're doing 3 hours a night.
Well, of course, that the thing is with digital, you can't do that now. You know,
you
don't with film. You it's hard because when the cans run out, you could never shoot a 60-minute take.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's embracing the new age and the way that things are done now. But it also means you can be more literate in how you produce. I mean, that was what was so good about. I mean, it was Jack Ketchum's book. Who was a great prodigy of Stephen King.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I don't know, I love that film. The only problem with that film is when we had the breakdown, when, you know, the guy who produced it, whose father bailed him out, and his father actually was the guy who built Watergate. Was the I can't remember the producer's name. He was also a manager. He was Rusty's, McKee's manager. And Rusty, you know, he'd shot it, and then it was a Thursday, I remember it well. We were told we'd be finished at lunchtime. It wasn't going to be happening. The film was stopping.
Wow.
And what it'd been is that because we were filming in California, we'd been paying hand over fist for locations.
Sure.
And the guy had run out of money. And his father was extremely annoyed. He said, well, why didn't you contact me? There was no need for it to collapse. I could have bailed you out. But as it happened, what happened is we went to Maryland and we shot it in Maryland. And it was a great space that we had physically. Sadly, Lucky bowed out. He had a row and he quit, which I was very unhappy about. And we had this Scott, he was actually a Scott Norwegian who directed it. But we did have a brilliant cameraman who came in at the same time, who he brought in, who did that 60-minute take.
Sure.
So that kind of thing. But it was a very traumatic show in that way. Just suddenly one day we were going on, everything, I thought everything was fine, hunky-dory, and you know. But I realized that they had been paying hand over fist for shops, commission, you know, and and that it got out of hand.
Sure. I noticed that it had two directors, but without the ampersand. And I was, I was wondering what the backstory was. And
no, that was what happened.
Sure.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful film, incidentally. And I think it's such a lovely character study of Avery.
Oh, yeah. No, I loved the character. I loved him. I just thought it was a great part, actually. It was one of the parts I really enjoyed playing, you know, because of the wife, what's happened. I mean, it's an incredible story, that story. And his, how he's been dealt with it, his inability to deal with it, and he's, trying to find, and then the dog, of course, is just the final straw that breaks the camel's back.
Yeah, and it's so true to sort of, it's perfectly logical what you're saying about the thought before emotion.
Yeah, that's right.
Every emotion after that, whether or not it's well-guided or not, you can see why someone might go to that step.
Absolutely.
It seemed reminiscent of one of your latest films, the Pigeon Handler.
All right.
What is it? Wild.
No, Little Wing.
Little Wing. That was
it. Yeah.
It sort of harkbacks to that in terms of the. Yeah. You're a kid who did a mistake, but we can correct this before it goes too far.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm aware of a time, so I'll ask this question, which I've asked everyone on the podcast: why do we need stories?
Well, I'm not a religious person. Mm-hmm. I was brought up as a Catholic, but I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in God. I believe that the one true church is the theatre or the cinema. Because what you see is how man, and by man I mean man and woman, how man deals with his life or her life, how they cope, and all the systems that go to infect that life or misdirect or direct that life. So, and, you know, I think that we've become so much hostage to our belief systems. I think that's the root of what's going on in Israel at the moment. You know, there's no question about it. It's the difference between Jew and Islamist. You know, that's the belief. The Jew is a settler. And that group of people are more nomadic. That's the other thing about, I'm doing an interesting documentary at the moment on archaeology.
Okay.
And discovered a lot, and the archaeologists have been going into Saudi Arabia and really looking at how Saudi Arabia was. And it turns out that Saudi Arabia was actually, the global warming, global cooling, that's not a new thing. That's happened to us ad infinitum. We've had an ice age, and at one point, the southern part of Saudi Arabia was completely fertile. It was green. It wasn't what it's become, sand. And the Nabataeans were the people who inhabited it. But the people who first inhabited were the Jews. So they have a settling mentality. And they settled. And of course, that's always been the difficulty, you know. And of course, then the Jews broke away, because we always have to remember that Muhammad was a Jew before he became a member, he became an Islam. So I've always found that these belief systems have really interfered with our being, basically our evolution as human beings, that we get locked into these things which trap us in a way. Now, what the theater does is it puts all those out to play and just says, this is all that stuff. This is what we deal with. And that's why I believe the real true church and the real true church of humanity is the theatre. Because it does, Hamlet says it in his advice to the play, holding the mirror up to nature. Mm. And that's nature in all its aspects, all its belief systems, all its, and the, the fallibility of those belief systems, because that's what's going on in, in the way it's what's happening in the Middle East at the moment, that they have, there's no ever any excusing of what Hamas did on October 7th, none at all. Absolutely horrific. And it's, and in a way, I think it would have been a better idea if they wanted to solve the problem is to take, they should have taken a bunch of hostages rather than, because now you've ended up by killing over nearly 10,000 children. And that's just despicable. It's absolutely despicable. And it really does come down to a belief system and the fact that the way some of the Jewish settlers have behaved towards some of the Palestinians. You know, and you go, these people have a right to exist, you know, because they were there for a long time. You know, they've been there. It's true that that state was created, but there's the only way to coexist. But of course, if you have that religious divide, there's always going to be that difference. And that's also a natural feedbed for havoc, and which is what we're witnessing now. And it's only been a matter of time before it explored in that way, you know. And that's why I think it's why the theatre does the job, you know. That's what. And when people come to see, for instance, Long Day's Journey, mm-hmm. everybody recognises aspects of their own family. You know, the mother who is addicted to Valium or what have you. You know, it reflects brilliantly on how lives are led. So that's why they identify, and also why they found it at times very funny, because there's a kind of ludicrousness about it. You know, about the behaviour.
Totally. Well, to end, as I mentioned earlier, in my research I found your favourite poem, which is I Am by John Clare.
I know. I mean, I have to say I do love Burns.
Of course, yeah.
Because it would be wrong of me not to do that. But it is my favourite poem because it deals with the existential nature of us, you know, of who we are.
Yeah.
And it's challenging. And when he wrote it, you go, wow. And of course, that was the great period of the great poets towards the end of the 19th century, you know, halfway through. Well, yeah. So it's probably earlier than that, actually. So it's really the whole of the 18th century, right, into the latter half of the 18th century into the 19th century. And it's an amazing poem.
It is, and I have a copy of it here, if you wouldn't mind.
I'll read it for you.
Thank you so much.
I Am by John Clare. I am, yet what I am, no man cares or knows. My friends forsake me like a memory lost. I am the self-consumer of my woes. They rise and vanish in oblivious hose, like shadows in love's frenzied, stifled throes. And yet I am and live like vapors tossed into the nothingness of scorn and noise, into the living sea of waking dreams, where there is neither sense of life or joys, but the vast shipwreck of my life's esteems. Even the dearest that I loved, the best, are strange, nay, rather stranger than the rest. I long for scenes where man hath never trod, a place where woman never smiled or wept, there to abide with my Creator God, and sleep as I in childhood sweetly slept, untroubling and untroubled, where I lie, the grass below, above the vaulted sky.
Brian Cox, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.